Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. President Trump has been critical of Mexico for what he calls that country's failure to tamp down on illegal migration that uses Mexico as a pathway to America for people from Central American countries such as Guatemala. A recent U.S.-Mexico joint declaration promised unprecedented steps to increase enforcement, and it tied international trade to the personal tragedies of thousands of people. NPR has featured reporting this week from the western border between Guatemala and Mexico. Today on In the Moment, we've asked Augustana Professor David O'Hara to join us for a look at a different part of Guatemala where he has frequently traveled and taught. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This is a country where you've spent a lot of time over more than a decade. Tell us about how your connection with Central America really began as a professor.
Well, I was a Spanish major in college and wound up spending a lot of time studying the history and culture of Latin America. When I started teaching at Augustana 14 years ago, I started with a class that I taught in Nicaragua. And since then, I've been teaching over the last decade or so in Guatemala and Belize.
All right. So for people who are thinking in their head right now, where exactly are we? Let's sort of paint a mental radio map picture of where Guatemala is.
I'm very sympathetic to that. I still remember all those times when I had to fill in a map for some social studies class and remember which country goes where. So if you go south from Mexico, Mexico has two countries on its southern border. It has Guatemala, that's most of its southern border, and then just a little piece of Belize. Guatemala really is the corridor from the rest of Central America to get into Mexico. On Guatemala's southern border, it's got Honduras over on the Atlantic side and El Salvador over on the Pacific side, and then Nicaragua and so on further on down.
Yeah.
Panama, Costa Rica. So you have basically all the pressures, all the economic pressures, and all the difficulties when there's a revolution or when there is political instability. There's your very narrow isthmus of land that connects South America and North America, which means there's not a lot of place for people to go to. And there is a highway. There's a corridor. You can drive from Panama up to Mexico, and people do walk that road as well. Mm-hmm. And most of that traffic follows along the Pacific coastline. There's also a big chunk, if you look at a map, I often ask my students, just go ahead and look on Google Maps, and you can see this really well, especially if you get the satellite view, you'll get a picture of this. There's a big chunk of Guatemala, almost a third of the country, it's sort of an unpopulated state called Petén, and that's up in the northeast. It's part of the Yucatan Peninsula. Mm. It's a very long border, and there's almost no way of crossing that border legally. There are no roads there. All the traffic, again, is over on the west side, the southwest side. Up in the northeast, there's this long, unfenced, unwatched border that's protected largely by a rainforest that nobody wants to walk through because it takes a week to walk through that rainforest.
So there's no checkpoints. There's no, structured way to address that border.
Yeah. That's right. However, as the population of Mexico has grown and as the population of Guatemala has grown, people have moved closer and closer to that border. And so there's been an awful lot of forest fires, people going intentionally setting fires in order to make land for themselves, burning down that rainforest. And those populations are getting closer and closer. Mm-hmm. The pressure on both Mexico and Guatemala to try to police that border has been huge and extremely difficult.
And you've spent time in this rainforest.
I spend time almost every year with my students down in that part of the forest, exactly, working with an indigenous group that's trying to preserve the forest, working with some of the local law enforcement and forest rangers as well, trying to keep track of what's at stake when we lose that forest and what do we gain by preserving it.
And have you watched that sort of, where are we at in the trajectory of is preservation and conservation always top of mind? Has it come in favor and out of favor over the decade or so that you've been going down there?
Yeah, it's plainly important to the people of Guatemala, just about everywhere. And at the same time, it's a super poor country. You got about 16 million people in Guatemala. That population has doubled probably in the last 30 years or so, 35 years. And in that time, there hasn't really been any increase in the wealth of the country. They don't have a lot of exports. They don't have a lot of resources, a lot of manufacturing. So people are looking for land in order to feed their children. That's why they're going to burn down those sections of the rainforest. But people also really care about their heritage and they care about the beauty of that place. Mm. But imagine what you would do if you knew that you had to dig up your garden in order to find gold.
Right.
You know, you'd consider digging up the roses in order to get gold, especially if your children were hungry.
And especially if somebody else is going to come get that gold if you don't dig it up.
That's right.
There's that sense of urgency as well. So when they burn the rainforest, is it using it for agricultural land? Is it just space to inhabit?
It's both. But what you've got is this immigration pressure coming from as far south as South America. Of course, Colombia and Venezuela, which Colombia borders on Panama. There's considerable economic and political unrest in those two countries. That pressure pushes people further and further north. And then those countries that I mentioned just south of Guatemala, El Salvador and Honduras, those two countries are really difficult countries to live in, as is Nicaragua. There's not a whole lot of economic growth. There's not a lot of money to go around, and the law enforcement is very difficult. So if you have political troubles, or even if you're just trying to inherit your own property, your own family's property, it's quite difficult to do that. If you find that there's rainforest that's really unoccupied and you need to grow some food, it's a pretty easy thing to do to burn down a couple of acres of the rainforest. All that ash creates pretty fertile soil for a couple of years, and then you can grow something there.
Mm. And then what happens?
Well, in the tropics,
a couple of years.
A couple of years. The tropics, the soil there is very thin. We have winter here, which means that our soil builds up each year. Plants die, they fall down, they start to decompose. In the tropics, things are growing all the time. So when plants die, they turn into new plants right away, or they turn into animals right away. You might find that the topsoil in a rainforest is only a quarter of an inch or half an inch deep. Mm. So you can grow corn there if you add a little bit of ash to it, but 3 years from now, that corn is going to grow a foot tall. 4 years from now, you're going to get nothing. So what you do is you burn down more forest and more forest and more forest.
And have you seen that happen? Have you seen over the years the footprint of the rainforest in Guatemala shrinking?
Absolutely, yeah. That I said about a third of the country is the state of Petén in Guatemala, and since 1996, when their civil war ended, about half of that, so roughly a sixth of Guatemala, has been reduced from rainforest to agricultural land, and that land gets weaker and weaker as far as its productivity goes. So there's just a really small section of the Maya Biosphere Reserve that's a protected bit of rainforest, legally protected, up in the northeast section of Guatemala, right along the border with Mexico. But there's no funding to protect that. And as the population grows, people are continuing to move in and to burn down the forest. And with it, they're losing archaeology, they're losing biodiversity, all sorts of wonderful species, scarlet macaws and jaguars and beautiful mahogany trees and so on, because people are hungry.
Tell me a little bit about, we mentioned this sort of western border where there are checkpoints, and then there, you know, it's porous for sure. There's
right.
no fence, there's not. But that's the easiest place to really cross. What's happening from a human perspective in this region? Do you see no crossing, no trafficking, or is it ripe for that because there's very little monitoring?
It's absolutely ripe for that. My friends who work as forest rangers down there tell me that they're frequently seeing people come over from Mexico into Guatemala looking for firewood or looking for bushmeat, you know, just looking for food, because there's hunger in small communities on both sides of the border down there. There's a handful of small roads that lead up to the border, and I don't know if this is good or bad, but up in the one corner of the Petén, Guatemala discovered a little bit of oil not too long ago, and that means that they've built a road up to that oil patch. Mm. So yeah, there's increasing permeability in that land there, and it's a great place for people to illegal trafficking. Of course, there's some drug trafficking that's going through there, but I want to emphasize this: the people that I meet in Guatemala, all across Guatemala, like the people that I meet in South Dakota, are good people who care about their families, and they're doing the things that they have to do in order to take care of their families.
Including, for some people, leave.
Quite a few of them have to leave.
Let's talk about the decision to leave.
Yeah.
The rainforest, your homeland, your family, and take the trek without necessarily a good destination at this point. Why leave?
Yeah, imagine that I told you that I was going to give you the opportunity to go and raise your family up in the northern Arctic. Most people in South Dakota would say, it's cold enough here as it is. Why do I want to go there? I've got family here. I know the town. I have all sorts of good things here. And that's what it's like for people in Central America. most people do not want to leave where their family is, where you've got papayas and bananas growing right outside your kitchen window, you know, where you can speak the language, you know the culture, you've been there for hundreds of years, your family has been there for hundreds or thousands of years. Why do they leave? They leave because they have to. The law enforcement in several countries in Central America is terrible. I often see young girls, 12, 13, 14 years old, walking around holding their one-year-old child on their hip. This is because the banking system doesn't work all that well. Guatemala actually provides contraception for all women free of charge if they want it. But if you can't earn money to put in the bank and there isn't a bank that's going to be reliable for you, your banking system will be your children. So you start having children as soon as you can so that you can have some kind of reliable source of income, more people to work. This is the same sort of thing that we saw here on the prairie 150 years ago. You know, if you have children to work the farm. The downside is that the population continues to grow. There's not a lot of taxable income, so there's not a lot of money to go around to pay for schools. Schooling ends in rural Guatemala at age 12. There's not a lot of opportunity for economic growth. So if you don't feel like you can build a business and that business will be protected by law, and if your only choice is to have more children or to leave the country, a lot of people are making the choice simply to leave the country. One of the biggest sources of income in Mexico, and as well as in some Central American countries, is remittances, money sent by Western Union or other wire transfers from the United States back to those countries. Mm. In other words, the people who are leaving are not, these are not lazy people. These are people who are willing to walk 1,000 miles or more in order to make money to feed their families. They make money here so that they can mail it home. Which of us wouldn't do the same sort of thing if we had to?
Do we have trade with Guatemala? Are there things, what do they produce? What are they known for?
We do have trade with Guatemala, yeah. So in Western Guatemala, there's a tremendous amount of tourism. Western Guatemala is beautiful. Actually, I think all of Guatemala is beautiful. Lots of archaeology, the volcanoes, the mountains, the rainforest, et cetera. We also find that in Eastern Guatemala, they've been growing more and more palms for palm oil. And for several centuries, we've been importing fruit from Guatemala. That being said, Guatemala doesn't have a whole lot of mineral resources, and they don't have a lot of other renewable resources. And the fruit trade is good for us, but it doesn't necessarily produce a lot of income for Guatemala. If you think about what you pay for a banana, some fraction of that is going back to Guatemala.
Right.
It's not a lot of money.
When you take students there, and many of them, this is going to be their first time outside of America, maybe even outside of South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've taught different classes there with different, you know, partners and, you know, collaborate with other professors. What are some of the things that you sort of help them turn their eyes toward?
Right. So the class that I most regularly teach in Guatemala is a tropical ecology class. And you could think of ecology as, you know, sort of like environmental science, and it is that. But we also want our students to see that whatever we talk about when we're talking about biodiversity and all the various animals and plants and the water and soil and so on, whatever we're looking at there, we're also looking at the people and the culture. So we want the students to come away with more fluent Spanish. We also want them to learn some of the indigenous languages. There's 21 different indigenous languages spoken in Guatemala, and about a third of the country speaks one of those languages, as well as Spanish. And we want them to spend time living in homes in Guatemala. So we arrange for students to rent rooms in homes in rural Guatemala and to stay there for a week or more and get to know people. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the very best things that they take away, because they'll never again be able to look at Guatemalans as an abstraction or Central Americans as an abstraction. When they hear about this migration, they go, oh, they're talking about people that I know. I've eaten a breakfast and dinner at their tables. Yeah. I've played with their children and in their homes, that sort of thing.
You've heard their conversation.
Tell
me about a breakfast conversation that you've heard and you wake up and you're with a family. Is it just like our breakfast conversations, pretty much the same?
It's similar, although I'll say that the family bonds there tend to be stronger than anything that I've seen here. So when I rent a room in a home in Guatemala, there might be 40 different people through that house in a given day, because the whole extended family feels free to come and go. So I might hear, if I'm there for a week, about 4 different marriages and about baptisms and about somebody who's going off to school to learn to be a hairdresser and about the party that's going to be happening down the street to celebrate somebody's new job and all these things. That sort of stuff, I might get more from my own family through Facebook rather than having that at the breakfast table.
Right.
Very close-knit communities.
Right. All right, tell me about the beavers.
Right, yeah, so I said that I wanted
to talk
to
you about beavers. We have
to make
sure we talk about beavers.
So I'm going to risk getting a little bit political here. We talk a lot about the importance of border security, and I agree. Border security is important for any country that wants to be serious about maintaining its own integrity. But if you just talk about border security in terms of building a wall, it's a little bit like talking about building a dam. It would be possible to dam the Mississippi River, right? You could dam it at the mouth of the Mississippi River and hold back all the water in the Mississippi. But the size of the dam would have to be enormous. And the amount of water that you'd hold back in just one dam would be enormous. And when that dam fails, and it will fail because the water's going to continue to build up, the failure will be colossal. But you could hold back that same amount of water at the headwaters rather than at the mouth. And nature's got a way of doing that. Beavers. Every beaver is going to flood 8-10 acres, something like that. And it's going to be 5 or 6 feet deep, and it's going to hold back that much water. And that water is going to start to fill up with silt, and that beaver is going to create new farmland. Now, we don't like beavers. We've been hunting beavers for centuries because they do that to our farmland. They cut down our trees and they flood our lands. But when you've got millions of beavers across the upstream, the headwaters of rivers, they are preventing floods. So back in the 1700s and the 1800s, Vermont decided to just put bounties on beavers, and they killed all the beavers. And several catastrophic floods followed after that when they eliminated the beaver population, including a flood that almost destroyed the capital of Vermont back in the 1920s. Because those beavers had been holding back so much water. So they had just one big rainfall. It came washing down. It melted all the snow, took out all the ice, and then took out most of the capital. What we are facing right now is something similar. We have huge migration pressure. It's almost like a river of people that are moving north, following the flow of capital. You know, they're trying to come here speak so they can make money and send it back home. They want to care for their families. What we could do is we could build a dam at the border. You know, we could build a wall at the border and say, no, you just won't cross this line. We can even push that back and push it back to Mexico's southern border, but it's still the same river that we're trying to dam. But the other thing that we could consider doing is we could try to build up the population of beavers in Central America and in South America. And what I mean by that is obviously not send them beavers, because that's not going to do any good. Beavers aren't a tropical species. What we could do, though, is we could look to make the kinds of investments in infrastructure, in law enforcement, in legal training, in education, in healthcare, in the development of industry, in innovation in Central America that would allow the people who love those places, whose families are there and who want to stay there, to stay there and to profit. The more that Central America flourishes, the less the pressure of migration on our southern border will be. Again, the people that I work with there, these are hardworking people. My friend Aderito is a ranger. He's an Itza person, an indigenous ranger, trying to protect a small section of rainforest. I was texting with him yesterday, and he sent me a map of all the forest fires that he's been fighting this year within a few miles of his home. Every one of those, he's risking his life. His only tool for fighting forest fires is a machete. And he and his friends go out with machetes. He was hospitalized because of the smoke inhalation earlier this spring. And he said, I'm ready to go back out and do it again. Thankfully, it's raining right now. So what he's going to do next week, he's going to go out and plant trees, try to reforest the area. I was texting with some other friends who work in law enforcement and who are rangers down there. Same thing. One of them said, a guy who was trained here in the United States in forestry, he said, the government has no money to support us right now. They tell me that they can't pay me, so I shouldn't go to work. I don't care. I will work until I'm dead because I love this forest. Mm. These are hardworking, patriotic people who love their people. They love their country. And when I'm there, they have the most amazing generosity and hospitality. I want to see these people flourish. And they want to see their communities flourish. I don't think any of them want to leave. If we can create the kind of conditions in their countries that would help them to stay there and to flourish, I think everybody wins in that kind of situation. And we're talking about a fairly small investment, especially considering the amount of investment we've put into military action in Central America since the 1930s. that has helped to destabilize some of these countries. I think that we can do better.
Are there ways to make that investment in a way that is not sort of superimposing, an idea of, prairie agriculture, for example, on to, the equivalent of actually sending beavers? Well, that's not,
right.
I mean? Like, my question is, do we have the kind of connections that we need to have to really find out how to make that investment in a way that's effective and not damaging?
Yeah, that's a great question, because obviously anytime we just try to throw money at a problem, right, some of that money winds up getting diverted to other purposes. One of the best things that we can do, I think, is we can find those people who are already at work at solving problems in creative ways in Central America and look for ways that we can make small investments in what they're doing. Not the great big kind of investments that are going to invite corruption, but the small investments that are going to invite innovation and help them to do that work well. Like I mentioned, the one ranger that I work with, right, who was trained here in the United States in Tennessee, he came here, he got a great education, he brought it back there, and he's been working his whole life now at using that to maintain the forest. I bring my students there so that they can go down there and they can see what the problems are and that they can continue to find ways to help to provide support to the people who are working on those problems. We have one of the most amazing educational systems in the world here in the United States, and lots of people here who speak Spanish. Plenty of people there in Central America who speak English. Creating scholarships for people to come here to attend our universities and to gain innovation skills and then bring them back to Central America, that right there would be an amazing investment. Mm-hmm. Doesn't cost a whole lot. Nobody gets hurt, and all sorts of good things can come from that. Plus, it creates goodwill.
Augustana Professor David O'Hara, thank you so much. You're welcome back anytime.
Thank you, Lori.